Well, the Bible is made up of all kinds of different texts. We know, of course, it's made up of a bunch of different books. It has poems and hymns, law books, history, prophecy, and narrative stories. How we understand these different texts really, I guess, depends on the style in which they're written. When you go to something like the Proverbs and it says, in one of my favourites, "Go to the ant, you sluggard, and consider his ways." It's a general piece of advice if you're looking for encouragement. Look at the ant, see what it does, it's industrious, you be like that. Of course, when you go to Deuteronomy and you hit the thou shalts and the thou shalt nots, they're really clear what they mean. Do this thing, don't do that thing, and you will prosper in the Lord. Again, we just had our gospel reading and Jesus told a parable, and we know as soon as we hear the word parable, we're thinking, well, the different people represent something and there's a big idea that I'm supposed to be getting and I'm supposed to work with that. Well, I think the narratives are a lot harder to do. What do we do with a book like Ruth? Are we just supposed to be generally encouraged that things look bad for her and then they came good? Should I read into it that if I'm ever in this position, if I tragically lose my spouse, that I ought to stay with my mother-in-law and look after her even if she moves to another country? There are some real challenges in really trying to understand what it really means. How do I get a take-home message about a story which is broad and doesn't necessarily have a specific teaching point? Well, today as we look at the second chapter of Ruth, I want to see if we can draw a little bit more out of the story by looking through the prism of relationship. How do each of the characters relate to each other, and ultimately, how do they relate to God as they're working through this story? And as we look at this, how might God be speaking to us and our relationship in our own narrative, in our own lives? And so I want to look this morning at Naomi, at Boaz, and at Ruth. As we jump into our text, it's helpful to remember where we're up to with Naomi. I don't know exactly what Alan was preaching about last week, but I want to start by just stepping back into chapter 1 for a second and having a look at where things started. As we're heading back, we know that a famine happened. Naomi and her husband Elimelech go out to Moab and they're looking to have some kind of life there. And their two sons manage to find two lovely women and they get married. And then things really turn bad. Elimelech dies. The two sons die, and Naomi is left utterly dependent with two daughters. And of course, in this early society, the men were the breadwinners. Women didn't really have much social status, and so to be without a husband, to be destitute in that way, was really a big issue. And so as she prepares to head back to her home country, to Bethlehem, her advice for her daughters is to leave her. It's almost comic. We sometimes miss a little bit of the kind of a comic frustration that she feels. She basically says, leave. Look at me. It's not like I'm going to get married again. Are you going to wait around while I get married, get pregnant, have some kids, they grow up and you marry them? It's just not going to happen. It's all fallen apart and she wants them to leave. See if you can find a life of your own. It seems like for Naomi, her life is over. There's nothing left to look forward to. There's nothing left to do. And there's nothing she can offer these two women if they were to come with her. So you might remember one daughter, Orpah, leaves. And then it's only Ruth that comes along when they actually arrive in Bethlehem. You have that moment of hope when they get to Bethlehem and we think, maybe this is going to be a pick-me-up. After all, the people were really excited to see her. Verse 19 tells us, the whole town was stirred and women asked, could this be Naomi? And her response is to say, don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. It's like she feels that God is actually actively conspiring to bring her misery, that there's nothing left. And Naomi feels that her life is going to doom Ruth to a life of absolute despondency as well. And this is why verse 1 stands out so much in chapter 2. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. This is actually kind of happening out of chronology. We're getting the inside scoop on the story. Naomi doesn't know that Boaz is there, and Ruth certainly doesn't know who Boaz is yet. But we know that he is in here, that he is the hero who has come and who is capable of bringing these people rescue. The writer of this book doesn't want us to go a single verse further into this passage without understanding that Naomi actually has it a little bit wrong. She's not actually a hero in this story. She's gone without hope and she's lost perspective. It's not that she's wrong for grieving the loss of her husband. I'm in one of those periods in my life where whenever I see families of any kind of television, if there's some kind of tension, my eyes well up because having just had that expansion in my family, anything that involves kids or loss or parents, or it really affects me emotionally. And Naomi's mistake certainly wasn't in grieving the loss of a husband and two children. None of us could really imagine what that must be like. Her mistake is in thinking that God is not in control of the situation and that God is unable to work for her good in this situation, that good can actually come into her life afterwards. Naomi has left no room in her life or her heart for God to actually shine through and to change her. But thankfully, God's plans are bigger. And we'll see a little bit later that things do come good, at least in a small way for Naomi. But first we need to look a little bit more at our title character. Well, if despair is the word that characterizes Naomi, or bitterness, then positivity and grace is really what characterizes Ruth. I remember moving to Scotland to live for 6 months when I was a little bit younger. I'd been saving up, I'd been looking forward to it, and when I arrived, I was suddenly frozen with indecision, where you have that moment and you realize, I have one friend in this whole country. I have no family. I have accommodation for 1 week, but after that, where am I supposed to live? I don't have a job. Without a job, I can't get a bank account. Without a bank account, I can't get a phone. And I had that moment of just absolute freezing. How am I going to live? What am I going to do? How do you go about life? Well, it was a little bit silly for me. I'm an adult bloke, and in the wonderful internet age, I could access my bank accounts from home and things like that. But for Ruth, on the other hand, she had every reason to be like a deer in the headlights. She's already lost her husband. She's moved away from all of her family and all of those things that she would have been comfortable with. She's a stranger in a strange land, living amongst an Old Testament people who were notorious for not really embracing the outsider. The Israelites set themselves apart, aside, and that didn't necessarily make themselves as welcoming as they might be. And what does she do? Does she become despondent? Does she go into a shell like her mother-in-law and just shut the world out? No, she goes straight to work. Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone else that in whose eyes I find favour, she says. What she was doing here was the lowest of jobs. We saw in the Leviticus reading we had that there was specific provision that the Israelites had made to make sure that the low people in society were looked after. When you reap the harvest in your land, don't reap the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner. I am the Lord your God. This was the rule that they had. They'd set this up so that the poor and the foreigner could at least eke out some really basic living if life was looking really bad. So when Ruth commits herself to this, she's not really committing herself to a nice job that she has that has great career prospects. She's committing herself to just the only thing that can actually keep her surviving. And yet in verse 7 we're told that she's even gracious in doing this. She's doing by what by law she's allowed to do, and yet she approaches the harvesters and asks permission whether or not it's okay to glean and gather behind them as they work. The very epitome of humility despite her circumstances. And there she is working away when Boaz finally walks into our story. The Lord be with you, he exclaims as he returns from Bethlehem. And the Lord bless you, the harvesters say in return. How do you find the measure of a godly man? Is it a question of whether or not they attend Bible study and other church activities during the week? Maybe it's a question of whether or not they read or pray or do other jobs up the front of a church. Or maybe it's whether or not they've been on the parish council, or even better, if they've been treasurer. Well, these might be things that somebody who is godly does and makes a priority. But the American pastor John Piper says that when looking for a sign of holiness in a man's life, the place you want to look is everywhere except what he does on Sunday morning. Are his life and his faith so tightly intertwined on the Monday to Friday that he speaks of God in every situation? Is a man's Tuesday afternoon witness the same as that on Sunday morning? Or has he wrestled with and reconciled how to be a boss and a manager and an authority and a loving and gracious Christian at the same time? According to Piper, this is an aspect of Boaz's character that often gets overlooked. Remembering that Bethlehem had only recently recovered from a famine that drove Naomi and company out, you might expect him to be really concerned about how his crops are when he comes back home. He might have 1,000 questions. How are things going? We haven't had any mites, have we? Are you getting this stuff done? Are we going to get it done in time before the storm comes in next week? He doesn't ask any of these questions, but Boaz's first words are to call a blessing unto those people he employs. And their willingness to do the same implies that they feel positive toward him as well. Straight off the bat, he notices this new woman and behind them, and he asks, "What does that young woman? But who does that one young woman belong to?" As a piece of general advice, in 2012, if you're visiting someone and you meet someone you don't know, can I suggest not starting the conversation with, "Who do you belong to?" In our time and place, we'd think that somebody was implying that this woman was a mere possession, like a slave. In those times, however, a question like that would more likely reflect an attempt to understand the family or the cultural group that she came from. As one commentator put it, in ancient Israelite society, the community to which one belonged at all levels, family, clan, tribe, nation, village, was all central to your identity and your status. And so to see this woman who is clearly not a Jew working in the fields, he asks, "Well, who does she belong to? Which clan is she a part of? How do I understand her context?" And when Boaz hears who Ruth is and what she has been doing for Naomi, we see his character continue to shine as a godly man. "Stay in my fields," he says. "You'll be protected. You'll be looked after. You'll have what you need." Boaz goes far and above the call of duty to make sure that this poor woman is cared for. And here we see the grace of Ruth and the generosity of Boaz collide in verses 10 to 12 in what I think is the real key to the chapter, the heart. Bowing face down on the ground, she asks, "Why have I found such favour in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" And Boaz replies, "I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and your mother and your homeland and you came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." I think this is a key, really, for two reasons. Firstly, Boaz has really embodied and also recognized the true heart of faith. If we turn to Micah 6:8, we could read, "And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Now, this is exactly what Ruth has done as she's loved and cared for and supported her mother. And this is the character that Boaz is showing as he's actually showing concern for her. And it's clear for Boaz that he's more interested really in the lived experience of faith than he is in the external trappings of it. Though, as Ruth points out a couple of verses later, she has no status or no inherent value in Jewish society, being an outsider as well as being a woman. Boaz sees in her an active and a vibrant faith, and he honours that faith as he honours her. Now, the second key aspect to these couple of verses is the recognition of dependence. I love the picture at the end of verse 12. "May you richly be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Ruth, despite losing her husband, has found faith in her heavenly father. So forsaking the gods of her own nation and all those things that she's grown up with, Ruth draws near to God like a chicka under the arms of a hen, under its wings. She sought deliverance and God has delivered. When Ruth headed out to look for a field to glean, she only knew Naomi's words that there was no redemption, no opportunity, and all she was looking for is some way to eke out an existence. She didn't know whose field it was that she went to. She didn't know who Boaz was, even if she had been told. And yet God brought her to the right field, to the right man, and to the right opportunity to find new hope. By acting with grace and trusting God, he has led her to a good place. I think for many of us, we spend our lives swinging in a pendulum, really, between Naomi's bitterness and Ruth's solid faith. The temptation is to hang on to our sense of hope in whatever our current circumstances are. If you're well, you're warm, you're fed, you're under a roof, your family are happy, then we feel God is with us. But when we come to those times of trial and difficulty, when we're forced to meet the unfamiliar, then we feel that God has deserted us. But the truth is that these are the moments where God grows us and shows us a greater vision. We'll see God's vision for Ruth grow over the following two chapters and even more in the following books of the Bible as well. As this relationship that starts so simply when a woman picks the right field will eventually lead to a marriage, to children, and to the birth of David, a man who is after God's own heart. We hit those patches where those things we value and enjoy have been stripped from our lives, and we look to God and we ask what he might show us as he has shown Ruth, what he has in store for us. How do we look beyond the bitterness that Naomi felt to the hope that Ruth felt? Well, the good news as Ruth 2 draws to a close is that Naomi's bitterness is not long-lasting. When Ruth returns with an ephah, that's about 13 kilos of barley that she had, Naomi says, "Blessed is the man who took notice of you." But the truth is of the matter is that Naomi is the one who's blessed. She finds out that it's Boaz, the guardian redeemer, as he's known. That is, he's a man whose job is to redeem the family members from difficulty. And her life as it was can't be returned to the joy that it had formerly been. But all of a sudden there is hope. There's new redemption to come. It's a great reminder for us in the good times we ought to be thankful. But in those difficult times we know that we have hope as well. We can thank God that in a modern, comfortable, affluent society we have amazing things even like social welfare. We'd never be in a situation like Ruth and Naomi. But we also know that the blessing that God promises is far greater than knowing that we're not necessarily going to lose our house or that we'll always have food in our mouths. That through the personal work of Jesus Christ, God has promised a blessing for us which is unmatched and unimaginable. Well, Naomi's going to find out a little bit more about her blessing. But of course, that is a story for us and for next week. So why don't we stop now, and we're going to thank God for what we see.